welcome to episode 2 of the DefendoCast with me, Lisa Schmeiser, joining me as always, as they did on our Sons of Anarchy podcast, which I'm not sure ever had a formal name, and on the Flash Flash cast are Phil Mozalek.
Hi, how you doing?
And Tony Sindelar.
Hello, nerds. Wait, Lisa, I already have a question.
Yeah.
This is episode 2.
Of the podcast, yes.
But we're talking about episode 1.
Of the series, yes.
Yeah, there's a lot of semantics.
How smart are our listeners?
Very, because they're listening to us.
Okay. I was a little confused.
I mean, yeah. Well, again, our listeners can be problematic, so this is 2-1.
Yeah. Well, maybe we could call the preceding episode episode 0.
Yes.
That works for me.
I like
that. All right. So the preceding episode was episode 0. Welcome to episode 1 of the DefendoCast with me, Lisa Schmeiser, Phil Mozalek, and Tony Sindelar. And also, I realized, hand to God, I do not remember if we ever called the Sons of Anarchy podcast.
I don't think we did.
I don't think we did either.
No. What was wrong with us?
It was early.
It was simpler times. We were not as into branding back then.
No, I guess not.
We were just about our motorcycles, gun running. It was a different time.
Yeah
it was more wholesome. It was more wholesome somehow.
Yeah.
Actually, and speaking of Sons of Anarchy, one of the biggest arguments for watching Luke Cage, which is a precursor to the Defenders, is that Juice is on as a villain.
It's true.
It's very disconcerting. Yeah.
Something like, is that what his character is? Is it Shades?
Shades. Yeah.
That's his thing. He's like Corey Hart. He wears his sunglasses at night.
He's not reference in this acknowledged. Episode.
Reference lost on younger viewers. Yes.
No, I acknowledged it.
All right. Here.
I've been to a museum.
Yes. I'm aging.
we're all aging. If you're not aging, write a book about what the secret is. So.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, let's get my own newsletter like goop. Anyway, to remind listeners at home how this is going to go, this is the episode where we talk about episode 1 of The Defenders. Our goal is to get through this in 30 to 45 minutes, which is still shorter than the first episode of The Defenders, so you win.
Right, because they already watched it, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so we'll do a flash recap of it as per usual and try to keep it under a minute or so, and then we'll launch into what's up with each character and who we were thrilled to see and who we're not so thrilled to see and maybe what hopes we have going into the series, all right? And I think since I'm the one who just informed you that we're doing a recap, it's only sporting that I do the first one.
Yeah, you cross the streams, you bite the bullet.
Yeah.
That's the way the saying goes.
I step in front of the streams and think and just be grateful.
Is
for
it
the
now? Is it? Do you have to do it like a minute flash style, or is speediness not as important in this new? I don't know what the rules are of this new podcast. Everything is different. Different is bad.
I know. Different is strange. You know what? Why don't I just try a recap and we can critique it after I do it? How about that?
Okay, just don't do like a Guy English 25.
Oh God! So. Please don't do anything like Guy English.
Fight. They punch each other. One of them punches back. And it's, you know.
All right. So what we're going to do basically, first episode of The Defenders, we meet each of the four Defenders. We meet Danny Rand, who is also known as the Iron Fist. He's called the Iron Fist because his fist glows in the dark. We know that his fist glows in the dark because he punches people in a sewer in Thailand, is it, I believe? And
Cambodia.
Cambodia. Yeah, he punches people in the sewer in Cambodia because he's trying to find out about his nemesis, which is a shadowy global organization called The Hand. He doesn't get very far. He has nightmares about how he's failed in the job he actually did fail in through Iron Fist, that job being to be the chosen protector of Kunlun, which is a city where ancient monks learn kung fu and apparently do not do a whole lot else. Anyway, Danny feels very bad about walking off of the job. He's sworn to take down the Hand because the Hand killed his parents. His girlfriend / infinitely superior kung fu partner Colleen is with them on these adventures, all of which are bankrolled by Danny's immense personal wealth, since Danny is basically like Tony Stark except nowhere near being a genius and just very good at glowing fists. So there's kung fu in his life, and the episode ends with him being like, I'm kind of ambivalent about New York, but I'm here. And Colleen is like, that'll do. So that is plot thread number 1. Plot thread number 2, we see that Matt Murdock is basically all by himself.
Whoa.
Because he's running a law firm by himself, and he and Karen have an exceedingly awkward exes pretending to be friendly over lunch type of thing, where she's like, do you regret, you know, giving up the daredevil lifestyle and no longer being a vigilante? Please say yes, please say yes. He's like, I sure do. And then, like, promptly runs to a priest and confesses about how he lied. And we see that Matt is winning victories in court, but he's not very happy that he's just won $11 million for the little guy. And at the end of the episode, when a freak earthquake rolls through Hell's Kitchen, you see him deeply weirded out by all of the stimuli, and yet, like, the daredevil part of him comes back online because all of his senses are alert and he's now listening for danger. So I think we're going to see Matt Murdock having yet another tortured relationship with his amazing powers. Plot segment number three, we meet Jessica Jones at the end of her series. Through a series of plot developments I will not go into here, she achieved what viewers hoped was some sense of tremendous personal resolution after solving an exceedingly thorny personal problem. However, as this series starts, she's having whiskey in her coffee at 9 o'clock on a Monday morning. She's clearly... reminding us all that recovery is not linear so much as it is just kind of a spiral where you end up back in the same place over and over again for a while until you fix things up. Anyway, Jessica goes to refuse a case where some woman's like, my husband, he's disappeared. And she's like, meh, I don't care. Until she walks into her office and then some voice in their phone says, don't go looking for the husband. And telling Jessica Jones not to do anything is basically like talking to a house cat, which is to say that that is the fastest way to get somebody to do something. So she immediately begins digging into this dude. And she is also a little bit weirded out by the earthquake at the end of the episode. And our fourth element is Luke Cage, who is being sprung from the pokey that day. We find out that Foggy was his lawyer, even though they had never met face-to-face. Also, Foggy's gotten a haircut, and it's not clear if he got the haircut because he's under the influence of his girlfriend, ex-girlfriend, Marcy, or if it's because he's now working for Jerry Hogarth's fantastic firm. Anyway, Foggy's got a haircut. I'm kind of weirded out by it. But whatever, Luke Cage comes back, rushes into... what's her face's waiting arms? I want to say Gail, and that's not the right name. Rosario Dawson's character. She's been in all four of the previous series.
Her name is Claire, and she's a biracial angel.
Claire, that's right. Claire is amazing, and I'm sorry I forgot her name. Anyway, Luke and Claire are really into each other, and it's great. And she's like, so what are your plans now that you've been released for this murder you didn't commit? And he's like, my plan is to be a hero. And she's like... and job. And he's like, I don't know. And so in this episode, he begins his work as Harlem's hero, not for hire because there's no money involved, trying to protect the last remaining child of a good woman whose previous two children were adult children were killed by brutal circumstances in the neighborhood. He also gets the best superhero scene in the whole thing, where during this earthquake that roils Manhattan and Harlem and Hell's Kitchen, a giant light pole is about to come down this woman, and just in the nick of time, he grabs it, he holds it, and it's just a beautiful visual. So we meet all of them, we get an earthquake, and then we get introduced to someone I presume is going to be the big bad. It's Sigourney Weaver. We find out that she knows Madame Gao, who was a peripheral baddie in the Daredevils, because she like worked with the criminal syndicate there, and a big baddie in Iron Fist, where we find out the depth and scope of her criminal activities and get shadowy clues about her past. Anyway, Sigourney Weaver's our bad new villain, and the last scene sets us up for another one of the big mysteries, which is where she's with the now no longer dead Elektra, saying, it's just a city. You get used to seeing them fall. So so we have at least two mysteries to unravel there. It's all very exciting. It's a great kickoff. That was nowhere near 45 seconds.
Yeah, you're getting you're getting close to a multi Morin type length, but I think you've covered very well on episode one.
Yeah. So yeah, it was interesting because I have to admit that my first response was to be kind of disappointed that Jessica had not, you know, followed through on the hopeful notes that ended her season. And then I was like, well, of course she wouldn't. This is Jessica Jones. She's not equipped for moving forward. So, you know, that it took me a minute to figure out that the writers are being pretty true to her character. But I enjoyed the introduction. I enjoyed seeing where these guys are. And I enjoy seeing how they react to it. So what else I really like is how and I think this got mentioned a couple of blogs too, but you guys noticed straight off, like, the lighting and the style of shooting is different for each of the four main characters.
Yeah, it's like going through a comic that's basically doing crossovers where, you know, the basic color composition gets changed over between who you're talking to or who you're watching. Yeah. The theme and the feel, I think that's what episode one is all about, is let's get back into these worlds, because some of you may have seen some of these, some of you may have seen none of these. So let's get into their worlds.
Yeah. And I love the transitions.
Yeah. And I don't know. I mean, I guess we've seen probably a decent percentage of the homework series leading up to this. But it seemed like it was relatively well constructed, such that, you know, if you had not, you know, if you were had not seen everything from before, you could kind of you could follow along with what's going on. And you might be a little confused, but it seemed like they chose good kind of entry points for seeing each person, right, and picking up with them. And, you know, it felt fun to see these characters, especially some of whom we have not seen for a while. And also it was nice that, like, all the BIP characters had their little moments, because they covered a lot of ground in this, you know, this 150-minute episode.
And only two of them really know each other, correct?
Yes. I was kind of I was expecting by the end of this episode they'd all be, you know, crossing paths with each other, and that we did not get that. So I'm assuming that is, I'm hoping we don't have to wait forever for that. I'm hoping that's not kind of the style where, you know, you wait forever to get the Daredevil costume. I'm hoping that we see them all teaming up sooner rather than later. But I did like getting the check-in with each of them. I like that there's this kind of mystery as to what's going on. And I'm assuming, just from my storytelling point of view, the mysteries are all going to connect, and I can kind of piece together some ways they might connect in my head from having just seen these. I don't know. I was pulled in. I would say I generally enjoyed this and felt like, and, you know, again, I have my kind of not feeling so super excited about ninjas, but I'm on board. I would say for me, the kind of the one point where I was kind of hesitant was the very first scene where Danny Rand is in the sewers in Cambodia fighting people. I was a little like, for that section, because I didn't think maybe Danny Rand was the best person to start with. Also, it was one of those fight scenes where it's like, I can't actually tell what's going on, because there's like four people involved, and there's the guy who gets stabbed, who I don't even know if he gets a name, but he basically gives him the bit of information that he needs to go back to New York City. And it's like, I don't know who this is. I don't know if I'm supposed to care. And like, yeah, it was a little too hard to follow as a fight
scene. It was too dark. Like, I really didn't like the composition. That's my one complaint that's consistent across the Precursor series, is that I find that the night scenes can be excruciating sometimes because the lighting is just so bad. And with this sewer, I was like, oh god, this is gonna be like the first two episodes of Luke Cage, where I spent the whole time trying to adjust my monitor. But I really, really liked the transitions, and I also really, really liked seeing Madame Gao, because I think her character is one of the most interesting shared universe examples. We first saw her, like, you remember she was in season one of Daredevil, and you see how Wilson Fisk is very courtly with her throughout that. He extends all sorts of courtesies, and you get the sense that there's a lot going on underneath the surface, and she's very closed-mouthed and keeps her own counsel. And then her character gets expanded substantially in Iron Fist, where she's actually she's one of the primary protagonists. And to see her pop up again and then have a connection to Sigourney Weaver, what I like about that is, even if you haven't seen Iron Fist, if you've seen Daredevil, you're like, oh, I remember Madame Gao.
And the way they depict her relationship with the Sigourney Weaver character is with very Alexandra, interesting.
Well, because you think, Madame Gao's on top of the stack, as far as we know.
There's always the villains all the way down. There's always a bigger villain, it seems like. And
she's a subordinate to Alexandra.
And actually, in episode one, I don't know that character's name. So they never use her name.
That's correct.
And interestingly, even I watched it with captions, they specifically just say woman for all of her lines.
Speaking of captions, Tony, Lisa... I know that I talked about this inside the Devil's Den, being mm-hmm. slack. But did anybody else notice the amount of sighs and scoffs inside the CC line 21?
Yes, there are a lot of scoffs.
Lots so of scoffs. Lots.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I defy any listener to make a count and tweet it to us. Yeah. It won't get you any points, but, you know, it'll get you respect.
Yeah, we'll retweet it. Now you've done it, Tony. You've issued the challenge. Phil, you've issued the challenge. I'm so sorry. I got my people wrong. Also want to talk at the very end, the very last scene has woman, because we're not calling her by her name yet, watching the chaos through New York. And she looks very serene as she does so. And then we see that behind her is a rather shocked looking woman in a red cloak. And as the camera pulls in, we see it's Elektra, who was dead by the end of a Daredevil season.
Very much
however,
so.
She appears to be, well, you know, at this point, you can't be, can't be spoiled. It's a thing. It's a plot point. So, you know, she appears to be alive. And the woman says to her, oh, it's only a city. You'll get used to watching them fall. So, Elektra, back on the scene. As Daredevil watchers, how do you feel about this character? And how excited or not excited are you to see her again?
I guess I just assumed it was inevitable the last time we saw her, she was being, like, loaded into that, you know, magic coffin in the basement of the hand with the symbols and stuff. Mm-hmm. So, like, I kind of knew that this was going to come back around. Yeah, I don't know. My feelings about Daredevil season 2 were not particularly positive. So
yeah,
so the threads from that are not super exciting to me, and that is a big one from there. But you know, I don't know, Phil. Yeah. You actually were probably you would have read these comics that had Elektra in them.
Yeah,
at the time,
you know, right? I get very tied to Frank Miller and his world at that particular point. So there are certain things that, like, I have in my head, I have, you know, cells in my head that I can see Matt holding Elektra's head and resuscitating her and resurrecting her. So I have to push a lot of that away. I will agree that, you know, for as much ninja stuff that there was in season 2, their relationship was good, like, first half of the season, and then I had a hard time sticking with it. Like, I didn't feel like they were in love as much as I've been told that they're in love, but I don't feel that constraint. So I was fully, I mean, look, I got it. Like, oh yeah, Elektra's back. Okay. What makes me a little bit more interested is this bigger bad that is ahead of Mountain Gal, and she's dying. And that's very interesting to me. Like, the idea of, I only have maybe months or weeks to live, and what am I going to do with my plan? And how Madame Gao reacted to that, that's more interesting than necessarily Elektra.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which, for me, raises, I mean, I think this episode poses a lot of questions, which is a good place to do at the start of a series.
Yeah.
I'm curious with, like, you know, she is dying. When it seems like, I mean, one of the things that has been kind of established is that death is not necessarily permanent for some characters in this world, but perhaps, you know, though it may not be permanent, there may be costs to it that are unacceptable for this person, right? Because that was the whole thing. I don't know if this gets filled in Iron Fist, but certainly was hinted at in Daredevil season 2, like, the fact that many of the ninjas from the hand were people that had died, like, and had, like, had been autopsied and come back, right?
Yeah, that's right.
That was that. So what happens, what you learn in Iron Fist is that Madame Gao is actually several centuries old.
Okay.
Or at least, like, she says so and people scoff and I don't believe it. But she's pretty open about it, like, through much of Iron Fist, where she's like, this century I was doing this and this century I was doing that. And immortality and the price thereof is actually the central one of the central plot points in Iron Fist. So in universe, we've already established that there are ways to bring people back from the dead. But they tend to come, there's a cost. There's a lot of costs associated with it. To get to this, an insight Mose had, one of my big problems with Daredevil season two was I understood why Matt was into Elektra. Because they make it very, very, he makes it very, very clear that his impulse control is about nil around her. And for somebody like him, who's got this overactive conscience and a strong sense of self based on moderating impulses, like the fact that she blows that out of the water and he enjoys it is, you know, clearly it's like, what is this compelling thing? I have to explore it further. Like, I get that. I never got the sense from the Elektra character that Matt fundamentally challenges who she is. Or alters or affects her behavior to the extent that she affects his, which is why I don't buy it as a big love story. I'm like, oh, she's the, I was like, okay, she's the ex who messes with you. And one of the reasons it's so infuriating is because you can never get to her on the same level. Like, that's basically how I saw it, which is why it's really hard to see it as a love story when it's just so vastly and radically unequal. Like, I don't buy that she really felt anything significant for him because I don't buy that she's capable of it. So that's my problem with the character. And I don't know how they're going to address that with this series, especially since right now it looks like Elektra is still wrapping her brain around the concept of city. So who knows how she's come back. But yeah, I have a feeling the reason they brought back Elektra is because this gives Matt some complications later as well.
I do want to say one thing about Danny Rand in general, like more of like something that I don't know what it is, but for some reason, whenever they say Kunlun, like it just Kunlun makes me laugh. Mm-hmm. Like it just doesn't, it feels like
you're not buying that the actor believes that that's a place.
That's exactly right, Tony. That's perfect. It's like every time it's said, it feels so forced that it just makes it extremely hard. And like, I feel like some of these characters, when he says stuff about Kunlun, that they're just like, that's not a real place.
I think, again, this comes back to, I feel like Danny Rand has been squandered because, well, his backstory is such where, okay, little boy suffers a terribly traumatic airplane crash. He's orphaned in the crash. He's in the middle of the Himalayan mountains in the snow. He survives only because a bunch of kung fu monks take him in. They remove him from Western civilization for 20 years. He somehow becomes the guardian of the city and then, like, throws it all out to go back to New York. So
he did punch a dragon in there somewhere.
He punches a dragon and to get his powers, but like the thing that doesn't, okay, here are the two things that I feel like writers really dropped the ball on with Danny is, number one, what would have compelled him to leave other than I want to find out who killed my dad? Because you would think that if he's in this kung fu discipline where you meditate and calm your mind and summon your chi and all that, like someone somewhere along the way would have taught him about learning how to resolve things you can't control and been like, all right, look,
very strange.
Like this motivation is like, it's really like, this is terrible training. If all of this spiritual discipline left him unable to deal with left him unable to grasp the answer. Sometimes things
it's
happen.
Hard. He's the iron fist, not the iron mindfulness. So
this is strong. The thing is, he's supposed to be this dude who, again, can punch dragons and defend cities and presumably has like control over his chi. So I don't buy.
So
his
why
motivation.
Does he act like a college sophomore?
Exactly. Like, I feel like they didn't think that one through. And the second thing is, again, I want to stress, you had a child who was brought up in like an ageless monastery where like watching peach blossoms drop and stealing goats counted as entertainment. So like, why, when he comes to New York, is he not basically catatonic for like a year?
I've been watching Arrow season one again because the Arrow guys are recapping it for their summer podcast. And like, Oliver is more lost from having been on an island for 5 years than Danny is from having spent like his entire life in a monastery.
In a remote monastery punching dragons.
It's like, how do you forget that part of the character? How is that not like a huge defining part of his, how, you know, that he can't navigate New York City and like he doesn't understand how anything works. And
Like, he would have been great as a character if he was basically like a functional idiot fish out of water the rest of the time, where people are like constantly having to explain things like shoes and subways to him, but he's like some savant fighter who's magnificently mindful and like this oasis of serenity when he's not punching things. And instead you have somebody who, like you said, is basically a college sophomore, god help us, actually a college sophomore with a Twitter account,
just back for Thanksgiving,
and they've just read Adrian Rich, and they've just read Adrian Rich for the first time, so they're busy, like, at the table, you know, they've read Bell Hooks, and they're like, you know, Father, you can't really disassemble the master's house with the master's tools.
He's a millennial, basically, is what you're saying.
Yeah. Well, no, millennials are in their 30s now, man. He's like, whatever comes next.
That can't be right.
But, yeah, it is. But, like, he just... Like, I feel like the writers really failed this character because there was a huge failure of imagination to extrapolate, like, how the qualities that make him qualified to be a dragon-punching city protector wouldn't translate to modern Western civilization. Like, they really could have had an interesting character where it's, like literally a clash of mindsets and civilizations, and instead it's like yoga dork. So, you know, I just feel... I feel bad for him because I'm like, oh, your potential has been so squandered. It makes me so sad to think about what could have been. And this poor little guppy is going to get eaten alive by Jessica Jones. I just know it. We'll enjoy watching it, but you know, this could have all been prevented in the writer's room.
Now, speaking about Jessica, now for somebody who maybe, and again, I don't believe in safe spaces, Where does her story picking up exactly?
So I don't have a really good sense of how time passes the Marvel Netflix universe.
That was my question too. It's like how much, because Luke Cage, for example, has served like a prison sentence, it seems like.
It was like five months though. It was not that long.
It was not that much. Where Jessica Jones, like that could have been Friday and today is Monday. You know?
So... I mean, I feel this is almost like an SAT question. Where
but like
okay,
why is that party. She doesn't, is she not opening up her investigations agency and she's done with that?
So I think, like, to go back to something I had said in the recap, I think this is supposed to show you that Jessica is never going to be good at moving on. Like, she just does not have the functional skills to be like, okay, I've learned from this experience and here I go. And, she is somebody who will always have to struggle against her self-destructive impulses, I guess. Because the end of Jessica Jones, and this isn't really spoiling, but the end of Jessica Jones, she conquers her demons, literally, figuratively. She builds her chosen community of people who look out for her, and she actually answers the phone and starts doing investigations. And then at the beginning of this episode, we establish that she's not taking cases. Her apartment's back to being a mess. But she's got two people who look out for her. And so I'm guessing that what happened is, like, after her big, this is my sense of purpose thing went away, like, she was like, I literally have no idea what to do next except drink. I mean, I think that's what you're going to see about the character is, like, if you had to put their priorities in descending order, it's Danny Rand, I have to defeat the Hand. And Luke Cage, I have to help Harlem. And Matt Murdock is, I have to help Hell's Kitchen. And Jessica's like, I have to have another drink. Like, that is basically their motivations in a nutshell.
I thought they did a great job of showing where she is, where, like, literally mother and daughter show up at her door begging for help, and she doesn't care. Mm-hmm. Shadowy voice says, don't do this thing on the phone, and she's like, well, now I'm gonna do it, right? Like, that's...
Yeah, that's what it does, is she does it out of spite.
Yes. Also, like, I mean, and just that her voicemail is wrong number is... Yeah. Like, so Jessica Jones in a encapsulated. It's not that there's no voicemail. It's that the voicemail actively tells you you've called the wrong place.
Yeah. Yeah. I do like to see that Malcolm is doing all right, though. It's nice to see that he's staying sober. I'm kind of questioning where and how Matt Murdock manages to walk into a case where he's suing a constructor who built a subway station, I guess.
Yeah, that scene where he's talking to basically now the handicapped boy. I know I can't say that, but I'm going to. He's in a wheelchair now. And that scene, like, there are things that Matt Murdock can do, Daredevil can do, that will pull up my heartstrings immensely. That scene is one of them. where saying like it, there's no sugarcoating it with Matt. It's yeah. This is going to be mile one of a marathon. You are not going to necessarily be happy. And this money is going to make your parents happy. You want your life back. You're not going to get it. But it's really kind of evocative of where he is at in his life. I mean, he's like, mm-hmm. In a sense, he lives in two different worlds, and he's kind of saying, I don't believe that I can be Daredevil anymore. But, that...
Which is weird, because at the end of Daredevil season two, that he had, leaned in hard on that.
That's
so
what I thought, but... Yeah.
I have no idea what caused the flip. What caused him to flip? I didn't get a good sense from the first episode that would explain. Because, the thing I appreciate about Luke is there's a real through line from his series to him getting out and going, yeah, I'm going to fix things now. And Jessica's thing kind of makes sense when you realize that she's never had decent coping skills. Even Danny Rand's thing makes sense when you realize that, like that college sophomore, he's really fixed on his one idea. And that one idea will clearly, fix everything.
He wants to love Karen, but he can't.
Yeah. Yeah, that was just...
Yeah, I it feels like we're kind of missing a piece there. Yes. About what happened, right? I mean, I guess I feel like maybe you have to fill that in with your head in terms of, Daredevil is from when his life, that he had a life with Foggy and Karen, and he doesn't have that anymore. I don't know. It was a little confusing. I thought that the Matt scenes were kind of the most affecting in this episode. In terms of the talk that we just talked about with his client, and even just the scene where he's practicing for the thing in his office, and he overhears some kind of incident happening on the street, and then a cop intervenes and he goes about his business. So I thought those were great scenes. That, and he also has his mandatory I'm Daredevil, I have to go to a confessional moment.
Yeah.
But those were all, I thought, kind of the most affecting scenes of the episode in terms of how much emotion Matt has. I agree. There's kind of feels like we're missing a little bit in terms of why is he not Daredevil right now? Or I'm totally blanking on a very important detail from the end of season two.
It's almost like he's not doing Daredevil in order to pursue a relationship with Karen and to not have this lie and say, I'm Matt, not Daredevil. And I can get behind that. But again, I mean, same thing, we're going to say it again, is there seems to be that little space between all of these shows and now that we have to kind of just fill in the blanks.
Mm-hmm.
Is that okay?
Which is not necessarily bad. Yeah. I think that's okay.
Well, Golden Tony would say that.
Yeah. I mean, I'm also, again, as my love of superhero team-ups, I see these characters that are all kind of going through their own little crises, and it's I am looking forward to seeing them working together and bouncing off each other, because like Jessica Jones is a total... basket case still, but she has critical skills for investigating, and because we have established that there's a series of intersecting mysteries. We need a private eye, even if we would prefer to have a private eye that was a more high functioning alcoholic, but that's not what's available.
We had to get the middling functioning alcoholic private eye, not the high functioning private eye.
I don't know if Matt Murdock presents some kind of legal help, or if it's just the Daredevil persona that helps the team. Luke Cage is kind of the most, he seems like he kind of has his hero act the most together of all the characters. And then, I don't know, why does Danny Rand own a car so he gets to come? I don't know why Danny Rand gets invited.
He walks around New York with bare feet, so he's got staff infection.
He's okay to drive.
Got an American Express black card? I don't know. So
so can we talk for a minute about Danny Rand and his big fund of money? Because he's the second billionaire in the Marvel Universe with the name Iron in his superhero title, and why do Danny Rand and Tony Stark not know each other?
I'm sure there's some
comic book version.
Yeah. I have
literally been wondering this since I watched Iron Fist and was like, would this not register? Like, would it have killed the writers to stick like a giant, hideous Iron Man branded like bouquet on a desk and say, oh, that's from Stark Corporation. Oh, that's from Stark Tech. They say, welcome back. And they look forward to doing business with you. You know,
it is hard, especially, you know, with Daredevil, it was in Hell's Kitchen. And so it felt like it was its own thing. Now that we've got this Defender seems very much like it's a broader New York story. And like because they've got the scene where Danny Rand is in the helicopter on their way back to New York City. And it's like, there's no Avengers Tower CGI'd into that New York. And even, you know, with the most recent Marvel movie having been Spider-Man Homecoming, which has a bunch of stuff that takes place in New York, though basically all Queens as opposed to Manhattan, like they feel like they're in different worlds. And, you know, that's not necessarily a bad thing. We don't need everything to be part of the one sticky Marvel connected universe, but it does sometimes feel like that was what we were promised, like, I don't know, 5 years ago. And they didn't.
Well,
they
that was like a core premise of Daredevil season one.
You're right.
Was that, you know, everyone talked about, well, Hell's Kitchen real estate because of the incident in New York. And there have been, and if you look in Karen's office, which was Ben Urich's office, there is the framed copy of the Battle for New York piece that he did. So, like, this is the universe where it happened. And I get that, like, the appeal behind the Marvel TV series is that they're closer to the ground, and it's more intimate, and you actually get to spend more time with these characters because you're watching them over a series of episodes. But, you know, when you introduce a known billionaire for one of the biggest companies in the world into a world that also includes companies that have been name-checked in Marvel movies, like Roxxon Corp, which has been name-checked in movies, or Hammer Tech, which was in the Luke Cage series. And again, Hammer Tech plays a big part in an Iron Man movie. Like, it's like they're writing as though the Avengers would never have anything to do with these guys peripherally. And if you're a billionaire, the circle of other billionaires is really small, and it would be something that you would expect Pepper Potts to follow, if not Tony Stark.
It is,
you know?
It's the hard thing with the comics world, where there's a lot of richest man in the world. There's a lot of greatest scientists in the world, and you could have an awesome party with the greatest assassin in the world. You know, it's, unfortunately, those should be three people, and there's about 150 people competing for those titles in the Marvel world. That makes that, when you then map that to a more realistic depiction, makes it all feel like kind of cluttered and weird. It's like, how are you guys not tripping over Iron Man suits left and right? And
it's not a huge complaint, because I'm enjoying this universe and it's filled with all sorts of things, but every once in a while I'm like, wait a minute, you know, it's you don't get to pick and choose. It's a whole world you're creating, and what's more, I feel like you're creating it for an audience of people who are really into world building.
Yes.
You know, so why are you not, taking that into account?
Yeah, because even Marvel Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., I mean, granted, that's really close to Avengers, but they don't have a problem bringing that kind of stuff in.
Yeah,
and it's, I mean, nerds have explanations for, like, what's going on with various, like, business deals and things like that, but, like, I shouldn't have to understand that to follow the story.
Correct.
Right. Like, yeah. I don't want to know what director is fighting with who and what deal has since been made. And now who owns the rights to what? Like, either this is all in a connected world and should feel connected, even if, you know, maybe not everybody has the rights to whatever, like, it should feel connected, or stop having sold us on the idea that it would be connected.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah.
So anyway, I don't expect my complaint to be addressed. I just still find it really weird that, again, Danny Rand, billionaire, which will probably be the principal value he brings to the team, that Danny Rand, billionaire, does not run around or at least have peripheral contact with other billionaires. Because, you know, if you are somebody who is a corporate titan and has all this money, it seems like you'd have the kind of personality where you'd want to check out everybody else who's on your tier to see who's coming for you, or if anybody's coming for you, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what Danny Rand's day-to-day is like, because, is he actively a billionaire? He's got a jet. But he's also in a sewer in Cambodia, so he's not yeah. spending a lot of time at the office. So
I'm pretty sure that Ward, who is, yeah, I always feel so bad for the two people, the Meacham kids who end up running Iron Fist, who end up running the Rand Corporation in Iron Fist, because they've basically spent their whole lives working for their dad and trying very hard to build the business and steward it and take care of things. And then in waltzes Danny, and he owns 51% of this business they've worked so hard to build over 20 years. So I end up feeling really sorry for them for that, because it's just got a gall to know that all of your hard work and you're like, nope, I now get 49% of the fun I used to have.
Mm-hmm. They probably know Tony Stark. They've played golf or whatever billionaires do, right? So, you know. There's your right. there's your
connection. It's getting there.
So that yeah. Danny Rand doesn't get to represent the Rand Corp on the golf course. He's no good at golf. Bored. Even though there should be a lot of connections between Kung Fu and golf, but you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did we push the limits of this episode?
I think we did. You know what? If I'm checking my clock now, we're at 41 minutes. We should wrap this up. So I want to thank everybody who tagged along for the ride on this one. This was the episode of the Defendo cast that covered the first episode of The Defenders. We have 7 more episode podcasts left, and then we'll do one final one to wrap everything up. Please keep your ears alert for special guest stars and nemesis, and more of the same from us. The Defendo cast is about to disassemble. I was Lisa Schmeiser, and with me were Phil Mosalak.
Goodbye.
And Tony Sindelar.
Goodbye, nerds.